Got my watch, so you're safe. My name is Kent. I'm an alcoholic. Really glad to be here and take care of some housekeeping chores. I want to thank the committee for inviting my wife and I up here. This is quite a crowd. I am not a circuit speaker. I don't do this. I speak a lot locally, but this is by far the largest crowd I've ever spoken in front of. Luckily, I have some old friends here. The fruit basket, which had a lot of chocolate in it, which is what I ate. I don't think I ate one banana, and I've eaten probably about 2 pounds worth of chocolate since I got here. So thanks for that. I don't keep chocolate in the house for a reason, but it was quite a treat. And thanks to Trish and Rick for hosting Corey and I. You know, it's pretty cool to be in a place like this. I always get nervous. I don't get afraid anymore, but I get nervous. And I like actually what my wife says. I get nervous actually for Alcoholics Anonymous because everything I have, not just my life, but everything good I have in my life is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And I want to be able to put into words what this program means to me and what it's given me. And I always like to say what my first sponsor said whenever he talked is that the only thing I really hope you get when I'm done is that there's no way I got from where I was September 18th, 1998 to where I am tonight by anything that I did. You know, I mean, I suited up and I showed up and I did the things you all told me to do. And somewhere along the line, before I got to step 12, I had a spiritual awakening and my attitude and outlook upon life had changed. And it's, you know, it's that old AA cliche that if, you know, my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'd written down what I wanted out of life, I'd have, you know, cheated myself. And I remember hearing that, like, you know, yeah, right. And then looking back, and I haven't been sober that long, it's like I would have sold myself absolutely so terribly short. I absolutely love this program. You know, I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I always want to start off a little icebreaker. A lady I spoke recently at a little place in Millbrook outside of Wetumpka, and a good friend of mine, Vicky, said, you know, are you nervous? And I got to thinking, it was kind of a small group, and I said, you know, I'm really not nervous because I have embarrassed myself in front of a large group of people before. When I was in the Army and I was sent down to Panama, where I spent many years, I was with a group. We used to travel across the world, and we'd teach different outfits, foreign armies, different stuff. And we were down there, and we were going to train back when Noriega was supposedly a friend of ours. We were training his Israeli-trained commandos on some advanced terrorism techniques and ambushes and raids and stuff like that. And I'd been through a 6-week Spanish course up at Fort Bragg. So, you know, I had a translator, but I didn't need a translator. I've been speaking Spanish for 6 weeks, right? And so the night before, I'm writing my preliminary notes and stuff like that, and I'm drinking, as I was wont to do. And so I'm sitting, I'm writing down, and you know, you always want to say something nice about the host country and the people, so I'm writing it down, and I'm translating it in English, you know. I said, okay, I want to say this and this. I said, okay, you know, people. What's the word for people in Spanish? I'm like, I don't remember. Something in English, you know, people, human, mankind. That's it, right? So that's what I did. So I got up the next day, and there's 720 Panamanian commandos up there. And I get up there, and my little translator, Luis Reyes, is sitting by me. And I said, and I'll say what I said. I said, you know, hola, mi nombre es Sargento Largo. Yo gusto su país y yo gusto los hombres panameños. And I realized the look on their faces. I'm like, oh, my God, I've done something horrible. And what I had said was, hi, I'm Sergeant Long. I love your country, and I like Panamanian men. So that was a showstopper. So, you know, with my keen alcoholic mind, I could tell from the facial expressions that I had said something awry. And I turned to Reyes, and I'm like, dude, what did I say? And he's like, man, you just said you liked Panamanian men. I was like, okay. So he was able to clear that up. If I embarrass myself tonight, it won't be the first time. I was born, starting in the beginning, I was born May 18th, 1962. I will turn 46 this Sunday. Now, like what the lady said this morning at the meeting, it was 50 years old. You know, to me and her, that's pretty cool because neither one of us planned on being here that long. So that's a blessing. I was born in Tokyo, Japan. My father worked for the CIA, and he was stationed over there. And I had a brother that was 13 months older, and 3 years after I was born, a little sister. There's no active alcoholism in my immediate family, and my sister and my brother are both disgustingly normal people. They went through life. They went to college when they were supposed to. They got married. They have kids. Their kids are normal. They're great parents. They're, you know, productive men. They live their lives the way I was raised in the same house. I have a disease of perception, and I just didn't turn out the same. But, you know, I was raised in the same house, and I've been through a few treatment centers, and I remember early on at some of those treatment centers, you know, there's some people that have really had a pretty hard go of it, a lot of, you know, physical, sexual, emotional abuse. And I used to say, man, I wonder if I'm repressing something, because that's why these people are alcoholics and addicts, because look at the horrible things. Of course, that's why they drink and use. You know, I wonder if I had a repressed memory. And, you know, the bottom line is I just drank myself into this deal. You know, the book talks about the difference between a hard drinker and a real alcoholic. And, you know, I know I started off as a hard drinker and I became a real alcoholic. And I don't know when it happened, but I know I was drunk when it did occur. I spent the first 3 years of my life was in Japan, and then we moved to Taiwan. And then we moved back to, for me, the first time, Washington, D.C. area. And that's where my parents still live today. And, when I lived in the States, I guess that would be home. And went to St. Michael's Parochial School, kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And then we went to Switzerland for 3 or 4 years. I had asthma very, very badly. I was actually given last rites by a priest when I was about 3 years old. I was never particularly large. I'm not large now, but I was, until I was 12, I was really, really stunted. So I think I kind of grew up with that little Napoleon complex. And I had an older brother. You know, Corey talks about her rivalry with her little sister. My older brother, I mean, you can imagine me now. I'm 5 foot five, about 140 pounds. Okay, 145. It's an honest program. My brother in eighth grade was 5'10", 180 pounds, and was shaving. And I think in seventh grade, I was like 4'8" and 82 pounds. And he was like a straight-A student, and I was a B student. He was incredibly athletic. It was enthusiastic. But the interesting thing is, you know, I always liked the disease of perception, you know, Chuck Chamberlain's series, his talk, because nobody in my family ever said, why can't you be more like your brother? You know, my brother never said that. It's just I decided early on I didn't measure up, you know, and that's nobody told me that. No one ever said that. So it was always a one-way rivalry with him. And I was one of those alcoholics that when I got here, I kind of thought that there was really nothing wrong with me except I drank too much until they told me to keep coming back. And I had these little moments of clarity of growing up that, you know, at the age of 7 years old, my best friend, Joe Kay, who lived down the street from me, he had a 19-year-old sister. And we'd go over to his house, and I would steal her costume jewelry and wrap it up and give it to my mother as a present, you know? And it's like, I thought everybody did that, and I've learned that, you know, probably that's not true. I learned early on how to lie to adults. You know that old honesty is the best policy? You know, I absolutely did not have any physical abuse in my life, but, you know, my parents did use the belt, and I'm just making this up, but, you know, the first time I can recall being honest, I got spanked. Ergo, honesty is for suckers. And so I learned how to lie. I learned how to lie. And my dad, doing what he did, we entertained a lot, you know. And I remember at the age of seven, I mean, I would, not a full suit, but a blue pants, white shirt, and a tie. And I knew how to set up a table for like six people, to include, you know, the 16 forks and all that. I mean, I knew that at age of seven. And when adults would come over, why, Mrs. Wong, what a fetching dress. You know, what seven-year-old should ever have to know how to say crap like that? But I learned early on how to say things to adults. And I remember, what a precocious child you have. My vocabulary was advanced beyond my years, and especially from living overseas. We didn't have TV, and both my parents read, were avid readers, and I grew up reading. And I used that to manipulate people and to tell people what I thought I wanted them to hear. And that was pretty cool until I got sober at the age of 36 and realized I didn't know who I was. I had lost myself along the way. And I used to laugh, not being part of the 60s generation. I was you know, a little bit after that, but in the 60s, you know, dude, I'm trying to find myself, you know, and then here it was in 1998 at 36, understanding exactly what they were talking about. I had no idea what I liked, you know. My wife said today, I didn't have opinions, you know. The last 7-8 years of drinking, I just drank, therefore I was. I didn't have any opinions. But, you know, I did always mention my family of origin because it was important for me that, for me, it wasn't my environment, you know. I just drank myself into this deal, and, you know, I probably do have a genetic predisposition for this, but I did all the drinking. My life started for me, at the end of 8th grade, my dad came home and said, we're moving to Singapore, you know, and we said, sweet, you know, where is it, you know, and we got the Atlas out, and we found out, and so we moved there, and it was really good for me because nobody knew my brother, nobody knew anybody. It was kind of a fresh slate for me, and I started my high school there, so I wasn't leaving the high school. And that's when I met, you know, it's funny, living in the D.C. area, all the people that we met as adults, you know, all the adults were, you know, military, State Department, government, you know, they were suits, briefcase people. And in Singapore, the Americans there were oil people. They were from Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, completely different breed. These people worked hard and they party hard. And I loved it and I loved them. And we moved, and in Singapore, there's no drinking age at all. I mean, we, like you heard Corey say, we could go into the Hyatt Regency Hotel at the age of 14 and order a drink, and it was no big deal. My parents were 2-martini-a-night drinkers, and still are. So alcohol wasn't a big deal for me, and I knew I grew up having wine on Sundays for dinner and never had an allergic reaction until I drank enough of it. That was the kicker. And when I got to Singapore, that's what happened. Met the Warren brothers, these three boys. Their dad was a big wig in one of the oil companies, and they had a big expense account, and they could just charge stuff to their rooms, and started drinking Heineken beers, you know. And I never had a spiritual experience drinking my first couple beers, but it made me fit in, you know. I became very comfortable. Prior to that, I was relatively shy and introverted, and I really became an extrovert in high school. You know, Corey said I was, you know, student body president when I graduated, and class favorite and king of the junior senior prom. And that didn't mean I was drunk all the time. In fact, I didn't really have a lot of drinking problems in high school, but it gave me confidence. It gave me a false sense of confidence, as it turned out. And I was able to come out of my shell and make friends. I didn't drink every weekend, didn't drink every day. I know I missed one football practice because I went to the bar with some friends, which was not unusual before practice, and I was too drunk, and that happened once, and then I had a blackout on my 18th birthday, on May 18th, 1980, and that was because of tequila. And that's the only thing that happened in high school. By October of 1980, I was drinking a gallon of Carlo Rossi Paisano wine before noon every day. It happened that quick. And what happened to me was... I was not and am not an angry alcoholic. I don't relate to anger. I'm much more comfortable with self-pity and fear. Okay? That's what I do. Self-pity and fear. And what happened when I graduated high school and I moved to Flagstaff, Arizona? I wanted to be a forest ranger. I knew nothing about what the career entailed. I thought you wore a green outfit and hung around in the woods, and that's what I wanted to do. But the degree is forestry, and I knew that. I mean, because I picked it was Northern Arizona University was back in the day was the third best in the country for forestry. But I had no idea that was a science degree. I'm a liberal arts type of guy, really. You know, history, foreign languages, social studies, geography, anything to do with math and science. Yeah, not so good. And so when I met my guidance counselor, she told me all these classes I had to take, I was absolutely filled with fear. You know, and it's just amazing. College freshmen, on average, what do they say? By the time they graduate, change their major like 12 or 13 times. I mean, it's perfectly normal, but it never occurred to me. I was just filled with fear, and I stopped going to classes if I thought I couldn't do well. You know, I never even tried to go and maybe I could do this. Consumed with fear, and I didn't know anyone there. There was 13,000 people. There was 99 people in my graduating class in high school, but only 33 of us had been there for 4 years. And it was just a bad deal. And I ended up, my parents pulled the financial plug after 2 semesters of that. you know, because I just wasn't performing. And I know I bummed around the state for about a year. I'm not really sure what I did. I truly don't recall. But I do know at some point my dad knew where I was, and he said he got me an appointment to the Virginia Military Institute. And was I interested? And I said, well, I got nothing else going on. Let's give it a shot. And so I went there, and I managed to last 2.5 years there because there were no women. There was no alcohol. You couldn't have a car, and they marched you to class. Okay? That's a pretty good deal for a guy like me. You know, and it was amazing because that was my first exposure to structured discipline. And I found out I did quite well in that. And it amazed me years later reading in the big book where it says, you know, we alcoholics are an undisciplined lot. And through this program, we let God discipline us. And I was like, that's one of my aha moments. Ah, I've been looking for it. You know, I could relate to the speakers that talked about, even in kindergarten, feeling like everybody else in class had the rule book for life except them. You know, I've been looking for, how do you do this deal? I've been looking for it all my life. I know people have told me how they do it, and I've seen it, and they got the same instructions, but I just don't hear what they hear. And so when I was at VMI, I did okay. But the problem with a 4-year degree is it takes 4 years, you know? And I also like what, you know, one of the speakers, I heard Wayne Butler talked about being the 50-yard man in a 100-yard dash. And I could relate to that. You know, I'll get halfway faster than anybody. I just don't close the deal. I just don't close the deal. And so after 2.5 years, I left. I remember home at Christmas, and I told my parents, you know, I'm leaving. I'm going to enlist in the Army. And that's what I did. And I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, and went to Basic Infantry School, Airborne School, and ended up in the 82nd Airborne up in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And what happened is I spent the next 10 years jumping out of airplanes and doing different stuff with different people and different types of airborne units around the world, and just drinking more and more. I'm alive today because I was in the military. The units I was in, it's in 3 different units. The first unit, we spent about 6 months of the year in the field. There was no alcohol. The second unit I went to spent about 9 months of the year in the field. So there was 9 months I couldn't get alcohol. And the last unit, sometimes up to a year, we'd be deployed somewhere and I couldn't drink. But always when we came back, especially that last unit, it was an unconventional unit. And they'd say, just take a month off, you know, and I'd weep inside because I get bad when I got a month off. All I do is drink. And no matter where I went, there was alcohol. And I remember thinking, I'm too young. I can't be an alcoholic. You know, what was Bill C. talking about last night? You know, it's the guy with the trench coat under the bridge. And also, I was a beer drinker. I only drink beer, and I was in great physical condition. I didn't drink every day. How can you spend 6 months without alcohol and be an alcoholic? Well, I'll tell you how. We'd come back, we'd usually jump back wherever we lived, and we'd, you know, march 18 miles or so back into the barracks, and you'd clean weapons, get off about 3 o'clock in the morning, and people would usually just be passed out in the hallways, so exhausted, and I would get up, no matter how late it was, and go to the shop and get a six-pack. Wouldn't even think of alcohol for 6-9 months, but if I was in a place where it was, I couldn't go to sleep until I had a six-pack. So what happened to me is, you know, things were just... I don't know. I just knew I wasn't living right. And I was maybe 30, 31 years old, and I was taking stock of my life and what's going on and what's wrong. And, you know, and I realized that the people that had the things that I were attracted to were family men. They were responsible. They had a wife. They had kids. And I figured that's what I lacked. I needed some responsibility. So I married a Panamanian prostitute I knew who had a, who had a 7-year-old daughter. Okay? Instant family. You know, there's a radio program down out of Charlotte, North Carolina called John Boy and Billy, and they always have this thing, you know, how'd that work for you? This guy named Doyton Hilbert. And the answer is always, not too good. But probably not for the reasons you think. What happened is that was the first time since I was 18 that I was out of a barracks, a dormitory type existence. And I had to do things like pay rent, pay my phone bills, balance the budget. And I found out I was incapable of doing that. And my life started spiraling out of control, and I was consumed with fear, with shame, with guilt, and just like a spree, what helped those feelings? I drank more. The more I drank, the worse things got, the more shame, fear, guilt, remorse, the more I drank. That was my spiral. I would do things like on a Friday, get drunk and buy my wife a $300 dress, and that was the rent money on Monday, you know? And I couldn't tell people, how do you do this deal? You know, I can't do this. I am unable to do what 16-year-olds that are emancipated can do. And I can't do it. I don't understand. I won't go into but the schools I'd been to in the military, I was either distinguished honor grad or honor graduate from every single school. How can I not be able to do this? And eventually what happened is, I missed 3 days of work, you know, and if you work for Krispy Kreme, that's okay. But if you work for the Army, they call it AWOL. And so my buddies came and got me, and, you know, lo and behold, I was a solitary drinker, so I thought nobody knew. Bill was also talking about that smell, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you shower, once you hit a certain saturation point, it comes out of the pores. So everybody knew that I was bad to drink, and they sent me to a treatment program up in Fort Gordon, Georgia, 6 weeks long military. And, you know, I am not a quick study. I've gotten recovery slowly. That was 91. It was 6 weeks long. And what I got out of that treatment center was that I was an alcoholic. They introduced me to the disease concept of alcoholism, and they proved to me beyond a doubt that I was an alcoholic. And I know they talked about the steps, and they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. All I heard was I'm an alcoholic, and the solution is not to drink. And I'm a pretty tough guy, and I do have willpower, and I've been able to use it successfully. And I'm not stupid, so I'm not going to drink. So I went back to Panama and went 6 months without a drink. And I'm one of those guys. I'm not a white knuckler. If I'm medically detoxed, I don't think about alcohol. And I was like, wow, you know, not too shabby here. When you drink the way I did, when you stop, I felt better. I could eat. I was getting along with my wife better. I said, wow, this sobriety thing's pretty good. I never went to a meeting. And 6 months later, during Carnival, which is what you all call Mardi Gras, you know, my wife went into a dress shop. I turned around. There was a Cerveza Panama beer cart, and I had two beers. And I stopped. I was like, well, this is interesting, because I thought what they said is if I ever drank again, I'd become a raving lunatic. That's what I thought they said. And I had two beers and I stopped. So I'm like, maybe I was too hasty in this diagnosis. And I had two more, right? And then I had a six-pack the Saturday, blah, blah, blah. 3 weeks later, I was drunk on duty, all right? Now, this was bad timing for me. For some of your old-timers, remember the days of Velcro rank, you know? You could, you know, be in a first sergeant on a Friday, get busted for, you know, whatever, on a weekend, they'd break it down to an E5 and 90 days later bring it back. Well, this was 1992 when President Clinton was drawing down the military, so they really had to set some stringent rules. And when I went to that treatment center, not being a lawyer, I don't read what I sign, I just sign. And there's a paperwork said if I had a drug or alcohol incident within a year, I'd be summarily discharged from the United States Army. And that's what happened to me. I lost my career, and I lost more than that. I lost my identity. My entire identity was my uniform. I was absolutely, completely shattered. I was nothing without my uniform. I didn't know who I was. I didn't have a purpose for living. I am now responsible. I have a wife and a daughter. I have no marketable skills. I'm not a tradesman. I don't change my own oil today. I can change a light bulb. I'm not handy, and I have no college degree, and I got, you know, 2.5 years of liberal arts classes, you know, and I jump out of airplanes and shoot people. That's pretty much my resume. So what I did was I drank more, and ended up back in the States ahead of my wife and daughter. They were waiting for visas, and I had, you know, a fair amount of money, saved up, that the Army had saved up for me. And so I got a hotel room and I just drank for 2 weeks and I got alcohol poisoning and ended up in another 28-day program and then into a one-year program. And at this point, my wife and daughter are back in the States and they're staying with her sister and her husband like 30 miles away, and I'm in this apartment deal with other alcoholics and addicts, you know, and I got other... All my roommates are alcoholics and addicts. I've got group counseling once a week, and I got individual counseling once a week, and I had to go to 5 AA meetings a week. And I went to 5 or 6 a week for a year. Didn't have a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. Okay, and this is important for me. This is, like I said, it's my experience. Keep coming back doesn't work for me because I got problems other than alcohol. Me, when I'm removed from the drink, I get worse. My book tells me drinking's but a symptom. The steps are designed to change me. The steps are designed to produce the spiritual awakening. The steps are designed to change my attitude and my outlook upon life. The steps are designed to remove the obsession to drink from me. If I don't do the steps, an alcoholic like me is doomed. And I'm telling you, I went to these meetings and I sat up front. I enjoyed the meetings. I didn't sit in half measures row. I didn't scoff. I loved the meetings. I just didn't hear. I know now. I used to beat myself up. I just wasn't freaking ready. But seeds were planted, you know. And I didn't have a home group too. You know, in the large metropolitan areas, there's thousands of meetings, and I'd go to just different meetings. You know, it may even take me 6 months to get back to a place I'd been before. And I thought I was doing great. But you see, once again, I was under some type of discipline. I was in a supervised apartment program, you know. And things went well until I graduated, and then I moved 30 miles away, back in with my wife and my stepdaughter, and I stopped going to AA meetings. I honestly thought when I got my one-year medallion, like it was some type of graduation deal. And what happened is I lasted 6 months after that. Once again, I went to a grocery store, and the idea of a beer popped into my mind. Just a quart, that's all, just a quart. And you know what happened is... my wife, God love her, she didn't know anything about alcoholism, but all she knew was I was bad to drink and shouldn't be drinking. And, you know, I was one of those, I drank a lot of beer and I'd eat Tic Tacs like nobody could smell beer. And she knew I was drinking, right? And so she'd nag. And it didn't take me but 4 days to make a conscious decision to choose alcohol over my family because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink and be in that house. And I came home one day and I said, I'm leaving. And I've not seen her or my stepdaughter since that day. And that was 94, 95. In my first home group, in your 1 year anniversary, you got up and told your story. And I said from the podium that we were separated. You know, my sponsor pulled me aside and said, you know, there's actually a legal term for what you did, and it's called abandonment. You know, and that's what alcohol did. I chose alcohol over my family. And I, at the time, I was working for the airlines, and I moved in with three pilots. A little single-family home up in Herndon, Virginia, right near the airport. And I had had enough alcohol treatment that I probably could have qualified for a drug and alcohol counselor. I knew what I was, and I didn't care. I was at that part in the big book that says, you know, you either go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help, and I was ready to go on to the bitter end. I was convinced that I was going to die of alcoholism. I didn't care. I wasn't hurting anybody but me. And what happened is... the first time that I can say in my life that I can look back and say, aha, this is a God moment. You know, I guess those who heard the Corey speak, you know, I got my first computer in February of 97. I had never touched a computer in my life, and I bought it and went to work that day and told the guys, got a computer and got an AOL account. What do I do with it? And they told me there's some different search engines. And the very first word I ever typed in a search engine was Singapore, you know, and I was like, hey, look at that. And, found out my high school had a bulletin board. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And that's where I saw a message. It said, from Corey H., class of 1980. And it was the only message from the class of 1980. And I knew who Corey H. was. Like I said, there was only 99 of us in the class, and I hadn't killed that many brain cells. And so, you know, you heard the deal. Sent the email, called her, and still laugh, 11 hours. You know, 18 beers in 11 hours, that's controlled drinking for me. That's thirsty. You know, we're saying we got married because we couldn't afford to date. The phone calls were too expensive. You know, and what happened is I moved down here with her. I took her hostage. I really did. And you'll hear how pretty soon. But, you know, I was reaching out. You know, this was a woman that knew me for the last time of my life when I was happy, joyous, and free in high school. You know, when I was kind of... The last time I felt I was kind of living God's plan for me, you know, when I was somebody, when I was full of potential. I was a completely broken, defeated human being at this point. And she had no idea that I was a raging alcoholic. When we did the long distance thing, I would fly down and spend 3 days with her, and I would literally drink maybe 9 to 12 beers in 3 days. I mean, that is outrageous control. That is control of heroic proportions, okay? But what was happening is I would always fly from Atlanta to Chicago, and I'd go to Chicago, go to a bar, have two drinks, and call in sick in advance for the next day because I had to get my drink on. And that's what I did. So I moved in with her, and, you know, I can't do that 9 beers over 3 days for too long. But I'm still doing a good job for me. I'm doing like a six-pack a night, which, come on, alcoholics, that's pretty cool. Well, it caught her attention. Once again, it was really nothing major. I mean, there was one time, though, I came home and she was crying, and I said, "What's going on? What's wrong?" And she said, "Do you have to get drunk just to be with me?" And it's like, wow, that hurt. That hurt me to see that, you know, the effect that I could have. That, you know, she thought it was her. And how do you tell someone? It's like, no, I'm not even drinking half of what I need. You know, it's got nothing to do with you. Hell, I'm cutting my drink down because I love you. And anyhow, what happened to me was, that last month or so, I'd like to say that September 17th, I wanted to try a new spiritual way of life, and that's not the case. That last month, I'd hit the last stages of alcoholism, and I'd gotten physiologically addicted. You know, I mean, I enjoyed morning drinking recreationally for years. I love drinking in the morning. The last couple months, I absolutely had to. And then that last week, if you can relate, to get the beer in the morning and like this, and it would take me maybe an hour just to drink one beer. And then the last 3 or 4 days, I could no longer consume alcohol. So the only thing that worked for me stopped working. That's what got me to September 17th saying I need some help, okay? So I went to the treatment center, my last one, God willing. And I went in there just, you know, try to get some medical detox and to buy myself 28 days to think my way through this thing again, right? And what happened is I was sick and tired of being me, you know? I wasn't sick and tired of drinking, which I'd been for years. I was sick and tired of being me. And I had a moment of clarity in treatment early on, 1 week, 2, I'm not sure. But 4 days? 4 days. She's my calendar girl. My memory's hosed. But I went to that family counselor she mentioned. And I said, "Look, you know, here's some things." I said, "I think I need to tell my wife." And I remember she's like, oh my. She said, "Well, you know, kind of like you do what you think you need to do. See you tomorrow." And but what I had to do is I had to be rigorously honest with her because I was tired of lying. You know, I remember one time, maybe 6 years before I got sober, my mother, in one of my infrequent visits at home, looked at me earnestly and said, "I think you might be a pathological liar." And I looked at her and I said, "I think you might be right." You know? And so I came home that day from treatment, and then I told Corey, I said, "Look, there's a couple things I got to tell you. I didn't graduate from VMI." See, VMI is the only college in America where you get your class ring. It's huge, the size of the Super Bowl ring. But you get it your first semester of your junior year, right? So I had a big old college ring. I also told her that I left the military during the early outs because many people then got significant amounts of money, like 25. I think I told her I had $25,000 in a bank account in Virginia. And I also told her that Mead Haven was my first treatment center. So I had to tell her, "I'm not a college graduate. I got kicked out of the Army for alcohol rehab failure. Oh, and by the way, this is my third treatment center, and one of them was a year long. But I'll tell you what, the truth shall set you free." I slept like a baby that night. Now, here's the deal. This was the first time in my life I was willing to take responsibility for my actions. It was my first time in exposure to recovery that I was willing to take responsibility for my disease. Previously, I wanted someone to wave the 28-day Blue Cross Blue Shield wand over me and cure me. Okay? Now, no treatment center I ever went to ever claimed to do that. Every single one of them told me the deal. This is Discovery. Recovery is an AA. To be honest, I wasn't willing to do it. I wanted the easier, softer way, and this is the easier, softer way. I thought Corey was going to leave me, and I was okay with that. Now, I don't mean, you know, I was looking forward to it, but I had to tell her these things for me, and that was the first time that I was willing to be honest with another human being and face some negative consequences. Because I, if she'd have done that to me, I'd have been gone. I'm a runner. She's a sticker. And that's why we're still together. She didn't leave, but she said she didn't sleep that night. So what happened is when I told my counselor on week two, because I didn't want to admit to him that I was a slow learner, when I finally told my counselor this was my third time around, he's like, "What do you expect me to do for you?" I'm like, "What do you mean? You're professional." And he's like, "There's nothing I can say to you that you haven't heard." I had been, what I think it was actually a term for it, institutionalized, you know. I'd heard the whole deal. He's like, "There's nothing I can do for you." And this is why I'm forever grateful. Not only was he a counselor, he was one of us, okay? And he said, "You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Man, I've tried that." And I said, "I went for a year." Now, I'll tell you, it threw him. He was like, "Really?" But then his training kicked in, his alcoholic training. He's like, "Did you have a sponsor?" I said, "No, sir." And he's like, "Ah." He said, "Did you have a home group?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Did you work the steps?" I said, "No, sir." And he's like, "You didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'm like, "Really?" And he's like, "I'm telling you, man." And he said, "You're going to go to 22 North California Street, Metro, at 8 o'clock. You're going there tonight." I said, "Okay." And I said, "Where is it?" He said, "You find it." Okay? I said, "Okay." And I did. It's like 6 miles from my house. And I went there, and I got a sponsor that night who didn't even want to talk to me until I got out of treatment. He said, "You go do that deal, and you know, you just keep coming here, and we'll hook you up when you get out." And that's when I came out, and I was on fire. You know, I really was. I was on fire. And I said, "I'm willing to do a 90 and 90. Because my first time around, that hadn't been coined yet, you know. So I'm showing him my commitment. He's like, "Well, good for you, Skippy. How about a, you know?" You know? He said, "How about a meeting a day for a year?" He said, "The meeting's from 8 to 9. We open from 7 to 8, and we stay from 9 to 10. I want you to do that every day for a year. Are you willing?" I don't think I was, but I said yes. Because I had no other choice. And, you know, and he got me into service. He was the alternate GA. My first thing, I was ashtray boy. I was the ashtray boy. When Bill was talking last night about being the guy reading the spiritual experience, my job was ashtray boy. And I did that for 18 months. And I came out of the bathroom one day, and there was a newcomer emptying my ashtrays. And I didn't even smoke, right? And I actually went, and I tried to grab the ashtray. And my sponsor was like, "It's time to let somebody else bring the ashtray." You know, And being alternate GSR, that's where my district met in this home group. And, you know, the old 40 cup urns that took 3 hours to brew 40 cups. Well, I had a small home group, right? We didn't get a lot of newcomers. So when one of us came in, all the old timers were like, "Sweet, we got new meat." So he immediately gave me a key and said, "The first Saturday every month, you're going to be here at 7 o'clock and you're going to make coffee, right? And then why don't you stay for district and see, you know, what district is about." And then he started having me go to area assembly, you know. And that's another thing that's really cool. I got to tell you real quick, Jim Spain sitting up front gave me my first silver medallion, which I still have with the hole cut in it. And I didn't know he was going to be here. And I turn the corner, you know, and I see him. You know, it brings a tear to my eye. And you're a special man in my life. And I come here and I see guys like Douglas. I mean, I've seen him at my first area assembly, you know, and Big Al, shy as he is and small. But there's people here. There's actually a lot of people here that I see at area assembly. And I've seen it, you know, different events at Hueytown and Bessemer and Sumatonga. But it was service that got me out of myself. Because I'll tell you, even in my home group, being there for 3 hours a night, I didn't share, and I wasn't allowed to, unless the topic was a step that I had worked, I couldn't share. And I looked at my feet, you know, and I talked to my sponsor, but I wouldn't talk to anybody else. And it was when he had like 12 or 15 people in the group. I was incapable of talking to people without alcohol. I was so consumed with fear, and I thought so little of myself, and I had nothing in common with these people. But getting to service, you know, and it's when I'd go to other groups, you know, filled with fear, and it's, "Oh, shoot, there's so-and-so. I know them from the PI committee, and hey, there's Lay that runs corrections." So I started having people I knew no matter what group I went to in Montgomery, and that helped me a lot. And it kept me accountable. See, it was a little bit of discipline, you know. There were times when I, you know, I find this hard to believe, I probably would not want to meet a service commitment, but it was a commitment, and people, I had said I'd be there. My sponsor told me early on, when I was talking about what is spiritual, what is spirituality, what do I got to do to be spiritual? And he said, "You know, for you," he said, "here's what you're going to do. Be where you say you're going to be, when you're going to be there, and use your left turn signal." All right? Don't ask me why, but see, that was simple. I could do that. I could do that. And that was important to me because my word meant nothing when I got here. I would always tell people I would do things and then be a no-show. I would never show up. I always had good intentions. When I told you I'd help you out, I meant it. But the problem was I was a morning drinker. You know, I'd get up on Saturday at 5 o'clock, give me two or three beers, and I had a spiritual awakening. And let me tell you something. I could do things or I could drink. I could not do both of them. I was consumed by alcohol when I had two or three beers and the physical craving kicked in. That's all I could do was drink. You know, Corey mentioned getting sober. I got sober in September. In December, we went down to a celebration by the sea, you know, and I heard Clancy and Mary Pearl. And I got to see that the Alcoholics Anonymous was much, much bigger than what was in Montgomery, Alabama. And like, wow, this is a pretty big deal. And it helped me a lot. And it got me involved in going to conferences and things like that in the fellowship, because there is a lot of power. There's a lot of power in these things. I went back to school in January. I had wanted to go back to school the last year I was drinking when I moved in with Corey, but I was incapable. I was absolutely incapable. So when I got sober and I talked to my sponsor about it, and you know, I was filled with fear, and he said, you know, if it's something you want to do, go ahead. And I said, you know, what if I fail? And he said, well, if you try your hardest and it doesn't work out, it means it wasn't meant to be. But, you know, you can't keep running from things that you want to do, because alcohol and fear had stolen my ambition from me, you know. So in January 99, I went back to college at AUM, and I scored so low on the math placement test. I went into computer science, okay, management information systems, because I wanted a job that I could actually get a job in. And I was filled with fear because it's science and math and computers. But I scored so low on the math test, I had to take two not-for-credit math classes just to take the Math for Dummies 101, you know. But I did it, and I learned stuff that I probably should have learned in fourth grade, you know, mathematically. But, you know, I ended up with a 3.96 GPA, and one of them was pre-algebra, and I had two classes in statistics with A's. If I'm not drinking and I go to class and I do homework and I read the books, I can get past the 50-yard line. I can complete the task. But I learned how to do that through this program, you know, through the fear, through talking to people and doing inventories and doing step work and taking the action, you know. And I learned that I'll always have fear. I just don't let it consume my life. It doesn't rule my life. And failure, if I choose, can be a learning experience. It doesn't mean I'm a failure. I had to divorce the event from the person. Corey mentioned that we used to go to lots of, every Saturday was date night, and I heard so many things from speakers in AA just in Montgomery that changed my life. I heard one of my good friends today, Tammy F., talk about, you know, I think she even went GED to college to master's degree in sobriety. And hearing Tammy, and I remember turning to my wife, and I said, you know what? I said, I believe I'd like to get a master's degree. The bachelor's was to get a job. The master's was for me, you know. I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, if you're into punishment, go ahead. And and I did. I've been able to get a master's degree in this program just for me. There was no promotion attached to it, you know, nothing. It's something I wanted to do. I've discovered I actually like learning, just for learning's sake. Another speaker meeting, a guy in my home group, Thomas V., talking about Ninth Step. And he'd been a guest of the state of Alabama different periods of time, on and off the years. And he'd been sober for a while, and he was talking to his sponsor. He said, you know, I've made my Ninth Step amends, but, you know, I just feel like I'm really not clean with the state of Alabama because of all my convictions. You know, what do you think I could do? And the sponsor said, well, you know, why don't you go to the Department of Parole and see what you can do? And it turned out what Thomas did is he asked for a pardon, and he got it, you know, and that kind of wiped the slate clean for him. And I said, that's pretty cool. I said, one of my biggest shames for me was when I got discharged from the Army, it was a general under honorable condition, okay? It was not a pure honorable condition. And there's a lot of shame, an awful lot of shame. You know, I told you the Army was my life. I absolutely love the people I served with, and I knew I had let them down in the United States Army as well as myself. And I talked to my sponsor. I said, man, I like what Thomas said. I wonder if there's something I can do. And my sponsor said, man, go to the VA and ask. And I did. And, you know, the government's got a form for everything. And there's a form to upgrade discharge. And took it home and I filled it out. And there's a whole portion in there. In fact, almost the whole thing is recommendations, right? You know, from priests, rabbis, ministers, doctors, lawyers, bosses, you know, whoever. And I didn't have any references. I mean, I didn't seek them out. None. I let just what this program had given me. At the time, I had finished my college degree. I was working for the United States Air Force in the computer field. I had a secret clearance. My credit had been repaired. I hadn't been arrested since I was discharged. Okay? And 6 months later, I had an honorable discharge. It's absolutely amazing to me. When I was a junior in college, I was walking down the hall. And my first sober job, I worked at Michael's Arts and Crafts, which was a humiliating job for a man of my ego. And you know, you can learn a lot in this program, but I'll tell you what, I'm not retail material. I'm just not a people person. God love people who are. But my sponsor wouldn't even let me get another job. You know how don't get another job till you have another, don't quit till you have another job? He didn't even give me that option. He said, you stay at that job until. And I was there for 18 months. But walking down the hallways at college one day, saw a little pink notice on the job board, and it said Federal Job Computers, and it was like $10.15 an hour, and I was making $5.15 at Michael's. And I'm like, okay, cool, and I'm in the computer field, maybe give me some job experience. And I applied for it, and I thought it would be something like putting memory chips in computers, you know. Hey, boy, put some memory in here. Hey, boy, put a hard drive in here. And that was cool because I, you know, get more money, get some hands-on. And I'd forgotten I even applied for it. And like 4 or 5 months later, I got a phone call from the AUM job people and said, come on down for this interview. And I went in there, and there was a civilian GS-14 and an Air Force colonel. And they were interviewing for a co-op position for permanent full-time civil service with the Air Force, a two-year period. And you had to have a 3.5 just to get the job. You see, that's another miracle. A guy who had been kicked out of one school and left the other with like a 2.0 and sinking. You know, the program gave me the opportunity just to apply for this, and I didn't even know what it was. You see, that's how I know things are from God. If I'm not involved, that's how I know they're from God. And I got this job, and 2 years after I had the job, when I graduated, they offered me a full-time job, and that's when I had to get my security clearance, you know. And my father, you know, I told you, worked for the CIA, and one of his last jobs, he was director of personnel. And he said, son, there's no way you'll get a clearance. You know, you're an alcohol rehab failure. I was like, yeah, you know, I think you're right. And I went and talked to my sponsor. My sponsor said, do you think God brought you this long for 2 years just to play a joke on you? He said, fill out the form and don't lie. I'm like, oh, don't lie. I'm like, ah. Oh. I said, don't lie. Because you know how anyone's lying, you know, be honest, you know. He said, don't lie. So I filled out the form. And I got the clearance because the job was contingent upon the clearance. And I got it. And I met the guy that was responsible for the clearance ultimately about a year later. And I said, how did I get a clearance? He said, well, the clearance was in 2000. Your rehab failure was 92. You admit it. Well, I mean, hell, it was on my records anyhow. But, you know, you've had it upgraded, discharged to an honorable. You haven't been arrested. Your credit is fine. Your employment record's fine. Your academics are fine. You know, we just want to see if people lie. And I'm like, really? No kidding. You know, if so it turns out, you know, you can do almost anything within reason as long as it's been, you know, in a relative period of time, not too recent. And it's like, wow, that's amazing. You know, I got involved, you know, besides, I mean, I became the grapevine rep and I became GSR and I took a meeting into the Maxwell federal prison for 2 years. You know, Corey and I went to lots of conferences and I always forget this part. In fact, actually, Mickey asked me about this ring. You know, I like what Bill said last night that you don't work step 12 and then you're done. You know, this program is a way of life. And I was sitting at work one day, actually about 3 years sober, and I realized, I told you that, you know, I was one of those alcoholics that thought I didn't hurt anybody but me. The gentleman that had to sign my paperwork kicking me out of the Army, he and I had a special relationship. When I was at VMI, he was one of the active duty Army officers stationed there as a captain. And he'd served with me at different capacities in all three of the units I'd served with. And he was crying. And He was crying as he signed the paperwork. And that just hit me. I was sitting at my desk. And I realized that. And so I got on one of the association boards and I found him, found an address for him. And I called him. And we talked for quite a while. And he said that he used to stay awake at night periodically wondering if he had done the right thing for me. And I could tell him, you know, there are a lot of sober people in the military. There are a lot of them. I could not have been one of them. And I said, you did the right thing. In fact, what you did for me was you started me on my bottom, you know, and that I was okay. And that I was able to tell him what the life that Alcoholics Anonymous had given me. And about 6 weeks later, he sent me a ring. He had a ring custom made. It's called the Triple Winner Ring. It's got the three units that we served with together. And that was a direct amends to a nine-step, you know, and I call him from work about once a month, and we email actually about once a week. And that's a relationship that's been restored. When that computer I bought, that first computer I bought that with a credit card I'd stolen from my parents, okay, and I ran up $10,000 on it. And my parents had actually not legally disowned me, but I was written out of the will, because, I mean, that's how they were, is that, you know, any money that they had would be dispersed amongst the other two children because I'd kind of gotten mine early, right? about five years ago or so, my wife and I were visiting my parents, who I call. I would go 6 years without even calling. I call my parents every week. We're not close. I still have a 72-hour rule with my parents, but I act like a son and I do the things a son should be, and we went to visit them. And they told us that they had made me the executor of the state. Probably because my wife might be a lawyer, but you know what I'm saying? That relationship had been repaired. They trusted me. They trusted me now. And that's pretty cool. I can't put a price tag on that. I can't put a price tag on that. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, Corey mentioned it. You know, I also like, you know, what Memphis Mike from Birmingham, who lives in Pensacola, said. I did not become a knight in shining armor when I got sober. I am a fallible human being, and I have character defects, and I had struggled with finances. And I got to tell you, I'll be honest, you know, when I came to Montgomery, Alabama, Corey and I got a U-Haul, the smallest one they have, and had to get a bar to put in there to keep my stuff from rattling around. And I was so proud of the fact that I was not materialistic. Do you know why I wasn't materialistic? I had nothing to buy, okay? I have discovered, man, I am powerless over money. It is a bad juju for me. And my first couple months sober, I had a little credit card, and, you know, I remember Corey coming home, and it's progressive, just like my drinking. Because the first time it happened, she's like, honey, look at this credit card bill. It's $353. I'm like, oh, that's crazy. You know, that there's obviously a problem. You know, give that thing to me. And I looked, and, oh, you see, here's the way, $5 here, and $7 here, $9 here, $20 here. How can that possibly add up to $353? Well, it does, and it happens quickly. So twice before, Corey and I put me on financial lockdown, right? And about 4 years ago, being the spiritual giant that I am, I think I'm ready for this. And what happened is, you know, I said credit repairs itself, and I started getting those offers, unsolicited offers, right? And so I started accepting them. And this is where it's, and here's the point I want to make. In the rooms, and I've done it for years too, it's almost a joke about retail therapy. All right, what I'm talking about is much more serious, because I spend money when I know it's not going to make me feel better. Okay, so that's different than getting angry at the wife and going out and buying a new pair of shoes. Okay, I'm powerless, and I get these things, and ended up with about $15,000 worth of credit card debt. But I had an allowance, and who cared, because I was able to pay it off, right, with out of my allowance. But here's what was going on. This is when I knew I was in trouble. Rushing home from work before my wife to get the mail. Okay? Because I'm getting three credit card bills and she thinks I have one. Okay? She said, you know, she'd say, hey, wow, that's really nice. Where'd you get that? Oh, I got this from so-and-so. I am lying to my wife. Okay? Uh-oh. Could be a warning sign. So what happened is I got an unsolicited offer in the mail for... what was it, like $25,000 from Bank of America to pay off my bills. I'm like, thank you, God. Let me tell you something. God doesn't deal in money. That was not a sign from God. So I got it, and I called, and they said, well, you know, Mr. Long, how much do you need? I said, well, I only need $15,000. Well, you're pre-approved for $25,000. Yeah, I really only need $15,000. And what happened is, so I got the money, and I didn't pay off all those credit cards. So, and this is a process of me, 9 months, right? And I'm just getting this knot in my stomach because I know the day of reckoning is going to come. But I tell you, I went to the bitter end. I came clean to my wife the day the bill came where my allowance could no longer pay all my bills, okay? Because that's how spiritual I am. And what happened is, I knew this was 9 years, and this was her third 3-year plan. But I had to get honest, and my sponsor, I saw my sponsor every day. I was doing 10 steps every day, but I wasn't telling another human being. See, one of the defects I got in Alcoholics Anonymous I didn't have was spiritual pride. I should be better than this. I can't tell anybody what's really going on because they will look down upon me, right? Like we look down upon people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's pride and ego. And what happened is when I told her, seriously, when she said it's just money, I almost died. Because it's like, what happened to my wife? That's not my wife. But she has worked a wonderful program. And I'm still here in the same house. But I had to do something, right? And there's a speaker I'd been attracted to for years, for 5 years, a guy named Scott R. out in California. And I remember one of his last tapes he had talked about. He had been through this at 16 years sober. And my wife was doing a fair amount of speaking at the time, and she knew some tapers, and she was able to track Scott down. And I called this man who I'd never met and asked him to be my sponsor, and he's been my sponsor since December. And he said, "Yeah, we can do this, man. We can do this because you're powerless over your finances, and we'll get you back in, and we'll do some work." And and there was nothing wrong with my other sponsor. Don't take it that way. I was unwilling to let myself be sponsored. Okay, that's what had happened for this period of time. And he has this deal out in California every February that all the guys he sponsors who can afford to come out there, they pay some money to a monastery and they have a retreat. And I went out there and I met what I call my band of brothers, about 15 to 20 twisted guys from all around the country, from New York to South Dakota to Oklahoma to California, and now myself, that all get sponsored by this guy. All of us at different lengths of sobriety, anything from 22 years, down to 9 months. And it was absolutely awesome, absolutely awesome. And I had to change some things up, and I've committed going now my new home. I had to change a home group, and nothing with the home group. I just had to do something different, I had to re-energize my program, and now my home group is the happy hour 6:30 a.m. group. And I go to a meeting Monday through Friday, guaranteed, at 6:30 in the morning. Sometimes we go to speaker meeting Saturday night, sometimes a meeting on Sunday. So, I'm just doing some more stuff. I'm doing what I was taught in here. If I got a problem, I'm the problem, and I got to take some action, and it starts with me being humble enough and willing enough to let another alcoholic know what is really going on with me. So, it's kind of funny, when this happened at 9 years sober, the same stuff that got me off of the alcohol 9 years ago is what got me back into the program and back onto the AA beam then. But thank you very, very much for inviting Corey and I up here, and just thanks for listening to me.